Missing Justice is an investigative true crime podcast from CBS News that examines the death of Christy Woodenthigh. On the night she was killed, Christy's family rushed to the scene in the Northern Cheyenne region and found no officers, no sirens, and no sign of Christy. This 6-episode series takes you inside what really happened that night and how the issues in Christy's case connect to the larger missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Listen to Missing Justice on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
Another day, another balloon shot out of the sky, raising lots of questions about what's going on and what it all means for U.S. national security.
The best case scenario is that this turns out to be the stupidest Cuban Missile Crisis ever.
Also today, an older generation in Japan remembers eating whale meat in the school cafeteria.
It's very rich taste. I thought was kind of delicious at the time.
Japan's biggest whaling enterprise is hoping people will again feel that way. Plus, here's the understatement of the century. Having a baby, especially a crying baby, changes everything. So a British group has made it their mission to help new parents.
And just a simple thing like somebody else making you a cup of tea or taking the baby while you went to the toilet, it really made such a difference.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. The number of deaths from last week's earthquakes in Turkey and Syria continues to climb. Today, an estimate put the total at more than 36,000 people. In southeastern Turkey, international rescue and recovery is a full-time operation. Across the border, though, in parts of northern Syria, outside help has been slow to arrive. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, getting any help at all depends largely on where in Syria people happen to live.
There have been so many aftershocks in the past week that people don't know sometimes if the earth is really shaking or if they're just imagining it.
I keep like a bottle of water next to me or a small cup or whatever, liquid base, just to make sure that if I'm right or no.
That's a Syrian university student. He's 27 and doesn't want to give his name because he fears talking with the foreign news media could get him into trouble with the authorities. He lives in the port city of Latakia, which is controlled by the Syrian government. The quake left a lot of damage, he tells me. Homes that are still standing are not safe to return to. So people are sleeping in mosques or churches.
There are so many NGOs that are trying to help. Other than NGOs, there are individuals who are making so much effort to give the people what they need.
Warm food, baby formula, diapers, clothes. Most of the aid is coming from the capital, Damascus. That's where Charlotte Stranger, a French teacher, has been organizing donation drives.
I teamed up with like 3 of my colleagues from the school. Spontaneously, like we created a scheme and we started gathering trustful contacts throughout the country with like people that we know.
She started an online fundraiser. In just 3 days, she says, she managed to bring in about $7,500.
But the problem is that as with everything that is linked to Syria, it was then blocked.
Syria is under strict economic sanctions. Last Thursday, the U.S. Treasury made a temporary exemption for aid related to the earthquake, but the sanctions are still being felt on the ground. Stranger says she could have used that money to buy things like food, hygiene products, and blankets.
It made me feel horrible, horrible.
The Syrian city of Aleppo, also under government control, was heavily damaged in the earthquake. Over the weekend, the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, visited the city and spoke to reporters.
We have just come today with some supplies and look forward to continue to support.
He arrived with a plane load of medical supplies. Aleppo saw widespread destruction during Syria's civil war, and filmmaker Yusuf Sabah says the quake brought down even more buildings. In a series of WhatsApp messages, he explains that help is beginning to pour into the city. Some are coming from inside Syria, he says, but also from outside. Aleppo even got the attention of the Syrian president himself. Bashar al-Assad and his wife visited a hospital on Friday. It was all smiles and hugs in this video shared online. But for Syrians living in areas that are not under government control, things are very different. In the northwest province of Idlib was hit hardest by the quake. 1 week later, people there say they still don't have the equipment needed to pull victims from under the rubble. Raed Al-Saleh is the head of the White Helmets, the only rescue organization operating in northwest Syria.
We want the UN to apologize. They're making the people of the Syrian people disappointed.
Martin Griffiths, the UN's emergency relief coordinator, tweeted as much yesterday. He wrote, quote, "We have failed the people in northwest Syria." Karam Kaliyeh is a photographer working in that part of the country. He says people are losing hope of rescuing victims trapped under the rubble. Those who survived, he says, have no shelter.
People, our refugees before earthquake, now in the road, in hospital, in schools.
Talking with Syrians in different cities, it becomes clear that there are really two Syrias. One under the government's control, where international relief organizations are helping out. The other is the opposition-controlled northwest, mostly isolated from the rest of the world. On Sunday, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, urged the Security Council to open another border crossing from Turkey into northwest Syria. But Russia, an ally of Syria's government, has veto power on the council. And so far, the Kremlin has said that one border crossing into Syria is enough. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
A U.S. fighter jet shot down an unidentified object over Lake Huron on Sunday. That was preceded on Saturday by another downing of an airborne object over northern Canada, the third and fourth such events in just 8 days. To find out what's going on up there and what it means for U.S. national security, we reached out to Jeffrey Lewis. He's an arms control expert at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. One thing we're hearing from some quarters, Jeffrey, is that, yes, there is a lot floating in the skies above us that we did not know about. Has this sort of balloon surveillance or whatever surveillance it is of the U.S. been going on all along, and U.S. military officials knew about it or didn't know about it?
I do think that this has been going on for a long time. If you look back over the past several years, there have been all of these reports of unidentified flying objects. And, you know, while some people entertain the idea that these were aliens or extraterrestrials, I think it seems really likely in hindsight that they were balloons and drones that were being used for surveillance. I think what's different now is we are now paying attention.
It's still very much unclear who owns these balloons or whatever they are. When he was asked by reporters on Sunday whether aliens could be involved, General Glenn Van Herk, commander of U.S. Northern Command, told reporters,
"I'll let the intel community and the counterintelligence community figure that out. I haven't ruled out anything."
I haven't ruled out anything. What do you make of that comment?
Sometimes I wonder what people are thinking when they say these things. You know, it seems pretty clear that these things are terrestrial in nature. The U.S. used reconnaissance balloons all the time during the Cold War. And of course, drones are something that are now an ever-present aspect of our life. And so, you know, like most things in life, the boring explanation is usually the right one.
Yes. Yeah, so how do you see the boring explanation here, that these are objects that are sent by another country? And if you had to pick, what country would that be?
I think these are likely surveillance assets sent from China. There is a lot of published research from Chinese entities showing that they are working on high altitude balloons and drones and airships. We have identified some of the launch sites in China and the wind patterns. So, you know, I think when you add up all the evidence, it's pretty clear that the Chinese are doing now what the U.S. did to the Soviet Union in the 1950s.
And if this is a spike in surveillance by China, why are they doing it now?
I think we're seeing the U.S. and China's relationship hit a very negative period. There's a lot of mistrust, a lot of hostility. And into that, there is naturally going to be this desire for spying and surveillance. And so we certainly in the United States spy on China, and they spy back on us.
Is there an argument, Jeffrey, that the more information adversaries have about one another, the safer they in fact are? Or is there only one way to see spying, that is gaining competitive advantage over another nation?
I'm somebody who thinks transparency is good and spying is part of that. So there are all kinds of historical examples where, particularly in the early period of the Cold War, when the United States did not have good information on the Soviet Union, we filled that vacuum with our own fears. And so we had an imaginary bomber gap and an imaginary missile gap. So I actually think openness, transparency, and mutual surveillance, on average, is a good thing. But there have to be rules, right? There have to be rules about what you can do, what you can't do. And absent those rules, then you run the risk of this kind of situation getting out of hand and developing into the kind of crisis that we've seen over the past few weeks.
Again, I don't even want to call them balloons anymore because we don't even have that much info to categorize all these devices in the air. But what do you see as the best case and worst case scenarios for what comes out of this collection of episodes?
The best case scenario is that this turns out to be the stupidest Cuban Missile Crisis ever, and we take a look at it and we learn our lesson, right? We see that our relationships with Russia and China are not in a great place, and we start thinking about what kind of rules we need to put in place to be able to manage this sort of thing. The worst case scenario is we just keep on the way we're going, and we continue to let these kinds of events dominate the relationship that we have, particularly with China. And that's going to be a case where we're very reactive and where we're really not able to achieve a lot of things we want because we're constantly going to be held hostage to these kinds of crises.
Jeffrey Lewis is an arms control expert at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Jeffrey, always good to speak with you. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
If you're a parent or have cared for newborns, a warning, the following sound may be triggering. Babies cry. Some seem to cry a lot. It's a reality, but it can be exhausting for new parents. A UK-based organization has made it their mission to help. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier with more.
Back in 2011, Emily Jane Clark was the first in her group of friends to have a baby. She didn't know what to expect, except for what she'd seen in the media.
You see these glossy magazines of mums that have just had a baby and the movies where they're all happy and smiling about this amazing baby. In my head, that was what it was going to be like. And it wasn't. It was just utter terror.
Clark says she was overwhelmed by having to care for such a tiny little girl. Her daughter was a couple of weeks early and weighed just 5 pounds, 9 ounces.
She just felt like I was going to break her.
Clark's daughter also had colic, which is when a healthy baby cries for a very long time for no obvious reason, according to Johns Hopkins.
You try feeding them and burping them and everything, and they just won't stop.
And the baby wasn't the only one crying.
Almost as soon as I gave birth, I just burst into tears and didn't stop crying for like months and months.
Clark's experience is shared by millions of people around the world. The CDC says about 1 in 8 people have symptoms of postpartum depression after giving birth. After a few months of panic and despair, Clark's physician referred her to an organization called HomeStart UK. Alex Courgier is the perinatal and infant mental health lead there.
Fundamentally, it's a model around parent-powered support.
HomeStart UK volunteers are typically parents themselves. They get matched up with new parents needing assistance, like Clark, and visit their homes on a weekly basis for a couple of hours. During that time, they can help in whatever way the family needs.
Maybe there's a mum that's had a new baby. She doesn't have her own family around, feeling a bit isolated. So maybe that volunteer just comes in as somebody that can have a chat, maybe think about going for a walk with the baby, being a listening ear, being there for them.
Volunteers can also help with more practical and financial challenges a new parent is facing.
Maybe be there when you make a telephone call to your landlord because it's a bit scary. Support someone maybe to go to a food bank if they're really struggling. Normalize that it's okay to do that. If you're in need, these organizations are out there.
HomeStart helps tens of thousands of families every year with 180 chapters around the UK. And an affiliated charity called HomeStart Worldwide supports new parents in 22 countries, from Sri Lanka to Zambia to Japan. British mom Clark says the organization saved her sanity by encouraging her to attend their parent support group at their local headquarters.
When you're always looking after a baby, you just forget to look after yourself. And just a simple thing like somebody else making you a cup of tea or taking the baby while you went to the toilet, it really made such a difference.
Before having her second baby, Clark had HomeStart support all set up in advance. Now, years later, she's a HomeStart volunteer herself.
I now do the making them a cuppa and holding their babies and stuff. So it's very nice.
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Up ahead, thousands of protesters in Israel see their country's democracy under threat. We'll explain why. That's coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Israel, power resides with the office of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There is a president who is something of a neutral figure in politics there, essentially a figurehead for all Israelis. But last night, President Isaac Herzog went live on primetime TV with a dire warning.
We all feel that we are a moment before a collision, and even a violent collision, that we're on the verge of an explosion.
The explosion President Herzog was talking about is Prime Minister Netanyahu's plans to reform the country's judiciary. If Netanyahu's government gets its way, a simple majority vote in Israel's parliament, the Knesset, could overturn any decision by the country's Supreme Court. Today, in front of the Knesset, anger erupted. Thousands of Israelis took to the streets to oppose the proposed judicial overhaul. Meanwhile, inside the Knesset, members met for a first committee vote on the bill. Things quickly fell apart. In this video, an opposition lawmaker jumps onto a table. He strides towards the chairman of the committee, pointing and yelling. You can hear the chant of shame, shame, over and over. Once matters were back under control, the committee voted and the preliminary legislation to reform the judiciary passed. It could be taken up by the entire Knesset as soon as Wednesday. Joining me from Tel Aviv to dig deeper on this is reporter Ariel Osaran with I-24 News. When is the last time you saw a protest like this in Israel, Ariel?
In terms of turnout, we have seen numbers like this in recent history. I mean, between 2020 and 2021, there was a year of weekly protests against Netanyahu with calls for him to resign over his corruption trial. And after that, he did lose the elections, but now he's back. And this is one of the concerns protests had back then, this exact judicial overhaul. But I think what makes this protest different is the scope of it. Besides the 70,000 who attended the protest outside the Knesset today, there was a nationwide strike, also protests in other major cities like Tel Aviv and Haifa. But you also saw the Attorney General come out against this, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, former prime ministers, economists, doctors, military commanders, high-tech firms saying that they're going to take their money away from Israel. All of them warning that such a politicized judiciary, which is what is expected to be at the end of this overhaul, it would mean pretty much the end of Israel as a liberal democracy.
What are they most worried about if this reform passes?
They're concerned that their civil liberties will be trampled on. Key members of this current coalition are parties that campaigned on an anti-gay platform.
Yeah, so pretty darn striking in terms of protests. I mean, we have to remember, though, that Netanyahu was elected by a majority of Israeli voters. I'm just wondering, is it believed that there are people protesting this judiciary reform move who actually voted for Netanyahu who now have buyer's remorse, at least on this scheme?
They won't be standing in the front lines of the protests, but you are seeing voices like that. But there is criticism also among the moderate right in Israel that this overhaul is a few steps forward beyond the demand that there has been in Israel for many years. Just when we talk about this, it is important to understand that unlike other Western democracies, Israel does not have a constitution. So the separation between the executive and legislative branches is very weak because the government almost always has a majority in Knesset. Mm. Add to that, it gives the government complete power over judicial appointments. This is a significant change for Israel's balance of power, granting almost all power to the prime minister.
I mean, given how divisive this all is, why does Netanyahu's government want these reforms of the judiciary so badly?
Well, again, for many years, there has been a claim in the right that there is need for reforms, that the courts, the judges don't represent the people, because unlike in the U.S., for instance, judges are elected by a committee that consists of politicians, judges, and representatives from the Bar Association. So there are checks and balances there. This new reform would give it all, would give a 5-4 majority to the coalition. That's one example. Another example is legal counselors in different ministries that politicians have long been accusing that they're preventing them from executing their political agenda, why they're being put in power. These legal counselors will now be political appointments, and they will no longer be independent.
So one thing that's notable is that Prime Minister Netanyahu still has an ongoing corruption case in front of the courts. How much does that complicate things?
The protests that I talked about 2020, 2021, they were warning from this exact situation, that when Netanyahu returns to power, he will try and change Israel's entire system of governance, the entire judiciary, just to avoid doing jail time. Now, whether you can connect the dots exactly that this reform will lead to his trial being annulled, that is not an easy line to make. But when you look at the broader scope as to what this will do to the standing of the court, what could happen is that Netanyahu's coalition could propose a bill that will let him off the hook. The court will drop it, but then the government, the coalition, will be able to override it given this new overhaul. So that is indeed an option, but he, as far as he's concerned and his coalition partners, they're denying any connection to his current trial.
Mm. Ariel Osaran is in Tel Aviv. He's a reporter with I-24 News. Ariel, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Marco.
Yesterday in Sharjah, that's one of the United Arab Emirates, the skateboarding world crowned its newest champion.
Frontside tail grab, backside Smith grind.
At only 14 years old, British skateboarder Sky Brown blew away the judges and the sportscasters at the Skateboarding World Championships.
Wow! Stepping it up from what we saw before!
Brown was already in first place when she just let it rip on her final run.
It was pretty emotional to see her do so well.
Oliver Perkovich was watching from Berlin. He's a founder of Skatistan, a nonprofit that combines skateboarding with education for young people in places like Afghanistan and Cambodia. Sky Brown is a cultural ambassador for Skatistan. She was born in Japan, raised in the UK, and at 14 is an international skateboarding superstar.
When you see her skate and she hasn't made a trick, she just keeps on going and going and going at it. I think that that's very inspiring for anybody that witnesses it.
Sky Brown has had a very successful comeback after an injury in 2020, a 15-foot fall during practice. At the time, she posted this message to fans from her hospital bed.
I don't usually post my falls or talk about them, because I want people to see the fun in what I do. And I'm just going to get back up and push even harder.
The next year, 2021, she dazzled the crowd with her gravity-defying performance at the Tokyo Olympics.
Everyone on their feet for Sky Brown.
Good enough to grab the bronze at age 13, making her Britain's youngest Olympic medalist ever.
Sky just has a very powerful style for somebody that is, you know, quite small in stature.
4'6", but in skateboarding, it's not really height that matters.
Sky is stylish on a skateboard, and that means a lot to skateboarders.
To anybody, really, who appreciates amazing athletic achievements. Bonus points for fine style. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Everybody knows about Swiss neutrality, but it's not black and white. Even with neutrality, there are shades of gray.
A neutral country is in wartime always criticized by other countries.
Still, some Swiss politicians say it's time for a change and to offer more support to Ukraine. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Large numbers of pregnant women from Russia have been arriving in Argentina in recent months. According to authorities in Buenos Aires, the Russian women are going there so their newborns can get Argentine citizenship. As the world's Tibi Saisea reports, this has prompted worries among some Argentine immigration officials.
Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine almost a year ago, more than 10,000 Russian pregnant women have entered Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, according to immigration officials. That includes 33 women that arrived on the same flight last Thursday. They were all in the late phase of their pregnancies. Six of these women were banned from entering Argentina because they had falsely claimed to be tourists, said Florencia Cariñaro, Argentina's national director for migration. She was interviewed by a local news channel. Cariñano said behind these women, there is a lucrative business that promises Argentinian passports for Russian parents. She said she and her team had interviewed hundreds of these women who said they purchased birth tourism packages online. The packages include plane tickets, airport pickups, accommodation, medical services, and even Spanish lessons for up to $15,000. Cariñado said the majority of these women have left Argentina already. The problem is that they come in, sign up their children as citizens, and then leave, Cariñado said. Once their children have citizenship, the parents become eligible for Argentinian passports, and those passports are valuable. They allow entry to 171 countries without a visa, compared to a Russian passport, which only offers visa-free travel to half of those countries. Cristian Rubilar is an immigration attorney who represents three of the women who were detained at the Buenos Aires airport last week. In an interview with a local radio station, he said, over the last year with the war in Ukraine, there are a growing number of opportunists targeting Russian women who want to give birth in Argentina. On Saturday, the local newspaper La Nación reported that Argentine police are cracking down on a $1 million business and illicit network that provides pregnant Russian women with fake documents to settle in Argentina while they sort out the citizenship process. Florencia Cariñado with the Immigration Department says these scams pose a threat to Argentina's international reputation.
Por ejemplo, los espías rusos que los encontraron en Eslovenia y tenían nacionalidad argentina.
She says last month, Slovenia arrested two alleged Russian spies holding Argentinian passports. If that kind of thing continues, she thinks some countries might start demanding visas from Argentinian travelers. For now, immigration authorities say they are negotiating to send the six detained women back to Russia. But it's complicated because the women arrived unaccompanied, with little money, without return tickets, and more than 30 weeks pregnant. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
Rescue efforts continue in Turkey after the devastating earthquakes there. As hope diminishes for finding survivors, a lot of blame is being thrown around. The Turkish government has issued warrants for dozens of people involved in the construction of buildings that collapsed. We can expect more arrests. It's estimated that nearly 25,000 buildings either collapsed or were severely damaged by the quakes. Joining me to talk about how this happened and the repercussions is Istanbul-based architect Sinem Boyacı. She's also a board member with the Center for Spatial Justice Turkey. Sinem, there is a lot of finger-pointing right now. The Turkish government is vowing to investigate anybody involved with the collapse of buildings. Already, they've identified more than 130 suspects, they say. Opposition parties are blaming the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for lax enforcement. Who is at fault?
I think the main fault is for the government, for sure, because they are on power since 2002. They made some changes in the regulations, in the laws about building control. With this regulation, the government unqualified the Chamber of Engineers and Architects on approving the projects. Before that time, the chambers were in charge to control the buildings, if it's on a suitable land. But after the change in 2011 and 2013, the government said only competent authorities could give the construction permit to each buildings. Those authorities were not under proper control by any organization. So now we can't survey if a building is definitely suitable for construction or not. We don't have any control process for analyzing it.
The Turkish government has also been offering building amnesties. The last one was in 2018. Tell us what a building amnesty is.
There are always some regulations and changes periodically made about building amnesty before as well. But the government made the last one in 2018. It has the most significant change about the permits. With this amnesty, illegal and unlicensed buildings have become legalized by government. All unlicensed buildings were legalized by the government. The government also admitted that they did not control the buildings in terms of earthquake resistance during this process. And today I saw a news that on this earthquake area, 290,000 of the buildings were legalized by this amnesty law.
So President Erdogan is facing a re-election campaign in May. Critics say his government is deflecting blame for the country's earthquake preparedness onto these builders, these developers. I mean, there is a lot of anger in the zones that have been severely damaged by these earthquakes. What does that anger mean in the overall life of Turkey in the months ahead?
People, especially in that zone, they are more angry than being sad, I think, because they think that they are left alone after the earthquake also, because we don't see any proper solution for any problem made by the government now. And I think they are a little bit panicked, the government, because they weren't expecting this also, I think. So they are doing some things. They are taking some actions, for sure. They are trying to do something. No one can say that they are just watching. But every step they take causes another problem, I think.
We'll have to see what happens in May with the election. Sinem Boyacı is an architect based in Istanbul. She's also a board member with the Center for Spatial Justice Turkey. Sinem, thank you very much for explaining this.
Thank you.
Since the start of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, European nations have mostly been united in their military support for Ukraine, to wit, large shipments to the government in Kyiv of all kinds of weapons. One European country has resolutely refused to do that. Switzerland has been militarily neutral for more than 200 years. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, some Swiss politicians say it might be time to shift out of neutral.
The concept of neutrality is so deeply embedded into Swiss identity, it's appeared in a Hollywood movie.
I'm tired of this. From now on, I'm Switzerland, okay?
That's Bella Swan, Kristen Stewart's character in the Twilight films. She's telling two men involved in a feud that she's not taking sides. But when it comes to real life, some Swiss lawmakers say this cherished national policy is no longer working so well. Thierry Burkhardt is leader of the centre-right FDP party in Switzerland. He says his country's neutrality laws are actually helping Russia. We're hindering the efforts of our Western partners to support Ukraine, he told a Swiss reporter, and that's the opposite of being neutral. Under the law, Switzerland is obliged to treat warring countries equally.
So if you would support one country, you would also need to support the other ones.
Laurent Gottschall is the director of an institute called Swiss Peace. I ask him if that means Switzerland will be obliged to send weapons to Russia if it provided military support to Ukraine.
Yes, in theory, yes.
This won't happen, of course, Gottschall says, because under the law, Switzerland cannot send weapons to any country involved in conflict. A few days after the war in Ukraine began last February, Switzerland did agree to support EU sanctions against Russia. And even this was seen as a major departure for the Alpine state. Jacques Pitelou, Switzerland's ambassador to the US, told NPR at the time that this didn't mean his country had abandoned neutrality.
We have to explain Switzerland's position all the time. I mean, even very serious and very big newspapers in the US spoke about Switzerland shedding its neutrality. Which made us recoil in horror because we didn't.
The Swiss government has been clear that direct military support for Ukraine is off the table. Not only that, but Swiss-made weapons bought by other countries cannot be provided to Ukraine either. A couple of days ago, Switzerland blocked Spain from sending anti-aircraft guns to Ukraine. Switzerland has also blocked Germany and Denmark from re-exporting Swiss-made ammunition to Kyiv. Some German lawmakers were not happy. They said arms deals with the Swiss should be halted. Thomas Bohrer is a former Swiss ambassador to Germany. He tells me the Swiss government was just upholding the law.
A neutral country is in wartime always criticized by other countries. And our government cannot go beyond the law just because Germany or other countries are pressuring us. That law, the War Material Act, would need to be changed, and then we could follow the wish of Germany.
The German government itself has been accused of dragging its feet when it comes to supporting Ukraine militarily. Jean-Marc Rickley with the Geneva Centre for Security Policy says Berlin's irritation with Switzerland may just have been a distraction technique.
At the same time that Germany was putting a lot of pressure on Switzerland to comply with delivery of ammunition, Germany was not willing to engage on delivery of Leopard tanks. Since then, the debate has evolved. But you can also see how finding a scapegoat and Swiss neutrality is sometimes a scapegoat to basically shift the focus from their own behavior.
But Swiss lawmakers are seriously debating whether the country's neutrality laws need to be updated, at least when it comes to re-exporting Swiss-made weapons. Political parties in Switzerland are divided. Green Party politicians worry that any change in the policy may be the beginning of the end for neutrality altogether. Jean-Marc Rickley says that's unlikely.
In average, neutrality has the support of 96% of the population. And that dropped to about 88% last July, but still it shows it's a very strong part of Swiss identity.
Still, changing Switzerland's neutrality laws would hardly be the first major policy shift by a European country since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. After all, few would have predicted a year ago that Finland and Sweden would be applying to join NATO. And a recent poll shows 55% of people in Switzerland now say they do support re-exporting Swiss-made weapons to Ukraine. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Vintage clothes are hot right now. Maybe you call them secondhand or pre-owned. A lot of shops selling these used fashions cater to the thrifty, the environmentally conscious, or hipsters, and often buyers who check off all three of those boxes. This trend is also being watched closely by some of the same companies that put many of those clothes into the market in the first place. They want in on this lucrative secondhand clothing market and claim it's all about going green. Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Selling secondhand clothes is pretty straightforward, whether you're a multinational or a teenage kid out for pocket money.
Lo primero sería ir a los productos tendencia, digamos.
15-year-old Luca Gatnau, a Barcelona 10th grader, shows me how he does it. I'm searching for trendy items on a secondhand site, he explains. Then I barter and buy. When I get the purchase in the mail, say a pair of sneakers, he says, I spiff them up, add great photos, then sell them for a profit. Usually for more than double, Gatnau says. So with fairly little effort, he brings in about $250 a month. He'll keep at it, he says, maybe even saving enough to start his own business one day. One thing's for sure, there is business to be done. The global market for secondhand clothes is around $72 billion, according to research from Future Market Insights, and it's set to grow by double digits over the next decade. No wonder the big players want in. Clothing giant H&M is on board already, selling its own stuff used online. Zara, the Spanish multinational, has just launched a similar portal. Both companies declined my interview requests. But their clients aren't shy. A shopper named Diana Ochoa strolls out of H&M's flagship store in downtown Barcelona with a bag of new t-shirts. I ask her if she's seen H&M's secondhand site, and she says no, she's never heard of it. But I like the idea, she says, if the price is lower and the quality is good. It's better to reuse clothes than to throw them away, she says. It's a way of polluting less. That's pretty much what clothing companies state on their websites, that they want to make their own clothes last longer. It's good for consumers and good for the planet. But some shoppers are skeptical. Just down the road from H&M, in a secondhand boutique called Olala, college student Laura Aguilar is leafing through hanger racks of dresses. They're faking it, she says. It's greenwashing. As long as the multinationals keep producing new clothes at the same pace, she says, their secondhand sales are pointless. They must be targeting people who just don't know what's really going on. The global fashion industry is among the dirtiest on the planet. It produces a tenth of all humanity's carbon emissions, according to the World Economic Forum, and it's the second largest consumer of water. Which is partly why clothing designer Alaya Reutsch quit her old job working for one of Big Clothing's big suppliers. She now works at Olala's main shop around the corner. I quit fast fashion 3 years ago, she says, because of the working conditions. From the very first clothing prototype, we were producing so much waste. That, she says, on top of all the clothes that eventually get thrown away by consumers. Broich wonders how makers of inexpensive clothing will turn a profit selling their items secondhand when they're already so cheap new. Economics professor Neo Soleil from Catalonia's Open University says it doesn't matter. It's not where the profits are. The big advantage of these initiatives, he says, is the big data the companies will collect. The world's largest companies like Google and Amazon, she says, are all fighting to create these huge databases about you and your shopping habits. It's the sale of that data that goes ka-ching, she says, not the used skirts. Soleil says if clothing manufacturers really want to go sustainable, there's only one way to do it. They need to go back to the old ways of making clothes, she says, so that they last a lifetime. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Right up through the mid-20th century, harvesting whales for their meat and blubber was a huge industry. Today, Japan is one of the few countries where some still appreciate whale meat. Even there, though, it's going out of fashion. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, Japan's top whaling firm has a new strategy to revive the industry.
There was a time in Japan when eating whale meat was common. Nanami Kurosawa remembers it well. Back in the 50s, when she was a little girl, every school cafeteria would dish out deep-fried whale meat.
It's very rich taste. I thought it was kind of delicious at the time.
That was after World War II, when protein was scarce, and the Japanese government urged whalers to help feed school kids. That program didn't last long, but some Japanese baby boomers developed a nostalgia for eating whale, and a resentment when the Save the Whales movement came along decades later. Not Nanami Kurosawa, though. She went on to become one of Japan's best-known advocates for protecting the whales, not eating them. She and her peers worked to persuade the public that harpooning these giant mammals is cruel. I asked her if young people in Japan today like eating whale, and she laughed.
Younger people don't like that taste.
Demand for whale meat in Japan is at an all-time low. Major supermarkets refuse to sell it. But Japan's top whaler thinks people actually do want to eat whale, but they're frustrated stores won't stock it, or they're embarrassed to bring it to the cashier. Here's Hideki Tokoro, president of the whaling company, Kyodo Senpaku. Supermarkets won't carry whale because they're afraid of anti-whaling activists, the CEO says. The public wants to eat it, but they can't. That's Mr. Tokoro speaking to Japanese reporters while dressed like a whale. He was promoting his company's latest gimmick, whale meat vending machines, dispensing whale steaks, whale sashimi, whale bacon, all sold in cans and available at the push of a button. Now consumers can buy whale with anonymity. There are a few machines outside Tokyo with plans to expand to other cities. Nanami Kurosawa, the anti-whaling campaigner, doesn't think the machines will be a big hit. She says most families threw out their whale recipes a long time ago.
I doubt they know how to cook whale meat. It's very difficult to cook compared to other animal meat.
She says the vending machine strategy is rooted in the idea that the Japanese public values whale meat as part of its culture, only they've been shamed by Western countries. She says some conservatives also believe this.
It's a kind of discrimination to Asian people or Japanese people.
The few Japanese whalers still in business are restrained by international conventions on hunting whales. Many whale species were nearly wiped out last century and are still recovering. So the Japanese whalers now stick to Japanese waters, going after species that are not endangered. They're only allowed to catch a few hundred each year. Mr. Tokoro is hoping to spark a whale meat revival, with plans to set up 100 vending machines across Japan in the next 5 years. Nanami Kurosawa isn't worried, though. She says most Japanese people agree with her that preserving whales in their national waters is good for Japan.
It's our heritage to leave to our future generation.
Kurosawa says the vending machine plan is just the last gasp of a dying industry. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Today's a big day in our newsroom. February 13th is World Radio Day. Guglielmo Marconi's remarkable contraption is still one of your main sources for news. Of course, a lot of so-called radio now happens on our phones. Podcasts have been booming across the globe for years. Consider the example of Ethiopia. The world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has more.
Netzanet is an Ethiopian podcast that describes itself as a talk show about Western problems in the Ethiopian context.
Welcome back to another installment of our podcast. This is Netzanet with
Tselate and Tsion.
Every time.
In the podcast, two personable female hosts weave in and out of Amharic and English. In this episode, they are talking about clubbing and how to be safe when going out. Others focus on issues like grief, feminism, therapy, and cheating. This is one of more than 300 podcasts and audiobooks that are on Teraki. It's an Ethiopian smartphone app co-founded by Nahon Segei.
Teraki is an audio streaming platform that hosts, produce, and distributes East African audiobooks and podcasts to the world.
The word Teraki means storyteller in the Amharic language. Segei tells me he and his co-founder created the app in order to make African, in particular Ethiopian, stories and storytelling more available. I downloaded the app, and as I scroll through it, I see a huge variety of topics.
Topics such as feminism, sexism, relationships, entrepreneurship, and other topics. And what they mean in our own contexts.
Here's how it works. Teraki helps authors turn their stories into audiobooks, from self-help guides to novels and even school textbooks. It also gives aspiring podcasters a platform, too. The final audio products are uploaded onto the Teraki app. So far, Segei tells me there are around 40,000 active users, and that number is rising quickly. He explains to me why.
After the COVID pandemic, online usage in Ethiopia has increased in a dramatic way. Even the internet penetration of the country is forecasted to increase up to 54% in the coming few years.
That's a big deal. Ethiopia is Africa's second most populous country, and it's very young.
So 70% of the Ethiopian population is under the age of 30, and this implies that our generation is highly and increasingly being dependent on technology.
And Segei tells me these new forms of digital media are also tapping into part of Ethiopian culture that goes way back.
Audiobooks and podcasts as ways of representing our identity and keeping our traditions, especially our oral storytelling traditions that have come from our elders.
The company also pitches itself as a way to bring the Ethiopian diaspora closer to its roots. For example, in this audiobook, an animated narrator tells different types of children's stories. Segei tells me that in his view, many of the young people today don't have strong connections with people from older generations. For him, audiobooks and podcasts are a way to keep Ethiopia's storytelling traditions alive. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nana Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
We were blown away by the support we received during our 2022 fundraiser. Over 668 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Gabriel Conroe, Hilda Guerra, Omar Habib, Dagmar Rurig, Patrick LaFlock, Jeff Noel, Kaori Hora, Debalina Ghosh, Peter Masurlian, Anthony Shuga. While we weren't able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to and supports the show.